Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. My guest today is Rob Orchard. He's a journalist and a co-founder and editor of Delayed Gratification magazine. Journalism isn't working. Media outlets are more concerned with being first than being right, and stories are built to create outrage rather than insight. Customers aren't happy with this setup, so Rob and his team began a slow journalism project, which focuses on finding signal from the noise rather than speedy delivery. Then he found a ton of fascinating statistics about the world, and today we get to talk about both. Expect to learn what the most popular crossbreed of dog was in 2020, how the Amanda Knox story shows how modern journalism is totally broken, what you should statistically do if you want to win an Oscar, why the 2010s was a terrible year for original cinema, why there's two golf balls on the moon, and much more. Rob's cool. Rob is a very cool British guy who is just doing something different with a small team that's a bit sort of contrarian and going a bit against the grain. And I think it's interesting. You can check out what he's doing if you go to slow-journalism.com. And if you want to pick up his book, An Answer for Everything, it is linked in the show notes below. This episode is brought to you by Crafted London. Finding men's jewelry that doesn't suck is very difficult, and Crafted London have nailed it. They are the number one men's jewelry company worldwide. They're sweatproof, waterproof, heatproof, and gymproof. They've got custom designs in gold and silver, necklaces, chains, pendants, bracelets, rings, and earrings. If you've seen me on any of the big cinema episodes on YouTube wearing a necklace, it will always be from Crafted. I absolutely love it. It works with formal wear, casual wear, whether it's daytime or nighttime. All of their pieces are super high quality. The designs are great, and I love them. It's all I wear. Also, they have an unlimited lifetime guarantee, so if your piece breaks for any reason at any point during the entire life of the product, they will give you a new one for free. Get a 15% discount site-wide on everything by going to bit.ly/cdwisdom and using the code MW15 at checkout. That's bit.ly/letter C letter D wisdom and MW15 at checkout. All right, quick maths. The less that your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have, the more money that you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce the costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite, and you are improving efficiency by bringing all your business processes into one platform. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the maths and see how you will profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/modern right now. That's netsuite.com/modern. This episode is brought to you by Whoop. I have worn Whoop for over 4 years now, since way before they were a partner on the show, and it is the only wearable I have ever stuck with because it's the best. It is so innocuous, you do not remember that you've got it on, and yet it tracks absolutely everything 24/7 via something from your wrist. It tracks your heart rate, it tracks your sleep, your recovery, all of your workouts, your resting heart rate, your heart rate variability, how much you're breathing throughout the night. It puts all of this into an app and spits out very simple, easy to understand, and fantastically usable data. It's phenomenal. I am a massive, massive fan of Whoop, and that is why it's the only wearable that I've ever stuck with. You can join for free. Pay nothing for the brand new Whoop 4.0 strap. Plus, you get your first month for free, and there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. So you can buy it for free, try it for free, and if you do not like it, after 29 days, they will give you your money back. Head to join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. That's join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. But now, it's time for the wise and wonderful Rob Orchard. Rob Orchard, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here, Chris. Nice to be here. Thanks very much for inviting me.
My pleasure. How do you describe what you do for work?
So I'm an editor. I edit a beautiful quarterly news magazine called Delayed Gratification, which I launched with my co-editor Marcus back in 2010, with an idea of providing a sort of an antidote to knee-jerk, Twitter-driven news reporting, which doesn't give journalists enough time to really get to grips with stories. So we kind of go the opposite way. Once every 3 months, we produce a beautiful magazine, news magazine, which looks back over the big events of the quarter with the benefit of hindsight and asks the question of what happened next.
So that's slow journalism that you've coined.
Yeah. So I'm not going to claim ownership of it. It's, a lot of people have been talking about it for a long time, but I think ours was the first magazine to put a flag in the sand and say, yes, this is a slow journalism magazine. And the idea is it's a bit like slow food and slow travel, right? So taking your time to do something of quality and kind of providing a counterbalance to sort of life getting terribly speedy and news getting terribly speedy and everything getting terribly speedy.
What's the big difference between slow and fast journalism?
Well, there's all sorts of different things. So what tends to happen in terms of the way that we process our news is that it's coming at us from all directions. You know, it's on our phones. It's kind of quite often the first thing that we do in the morning, right? Instead of turning to our loved one, we turn on our phones and we check and make sure nothing horrible has happened overnight. And last thing at night as well, and throughout the day, and on our socials, and it's kind of this white noise of news. And what tends to happen as well is that it moves in kind of cycles. So you get an intense concentration on a massive story for a few days, and then suddenly the news agenda moves on. And you're quite often left with the sort of the feeling of not having really got to grips with what the story was or wanting to know what happened next. But you know, the news cycle feeds on novelty, and so it's kind of constantly moving on. So to take an example, Afghanistan, we were all glued to the story over the summer in August, August 15th, the fall of Kabul and the kind of the few days leading up to that and the few days after that. But since then, the coverage of what's been happening in Afghanistan has completely fallen off a cliff. And we happen to have in the next issue a very well-written, a very well-considered piece from a female journalist who's been there for the last year and who continued, very bravely continued, didn't leave with everybody else, stayed there, and has got this incredible 6,000-word read for us, really getting to grips with what has happened in the country since then. So I suppose when it works well, what it is you open up the magazine or you know, wherever you read it, you open up the magazine, and you think, God, yeah, that story, what the hell happened to that? I remember that. And we tell you, you know, and in amongst that, we also tell you the stories that you missed. We have this kind of slightly cheesy line of the stories others missed or mistold. So this idea of in the kind of the heat of you know, like 24/7 rolling news, there's stuff that gets missed and there's stuff that gets put out there wrongly. So this is ideally, in its best form, it's an antidote to that.
I remember doing an AS level in social media. In media studies and sociology. So a quarter of an A level in media studies. And even then, I remember learning about on 9/11, the way that certain companies' executives said it's a good day for bad news. And they released tons and tons of weird, murky stories that they just needed to kick out into the press because they knew it was going to be relegated to page 105 and it didn't really matter. So that's super. So that's before social media, that's before Twitter, that's before rapid smartphone delivery for information and disinformation and misinformation. And even then, people were able to play these games and they were able to work with the if it bleeds, it leads seductiveness for the press to look at the things that are in front of them. And there's now even more. It sounds like we're delivered the front end of the story because that's where the novelty lies, but we never close the loop around what actually happened in the story because who cares about closure? All that anyone wants to know about is what's new.
Yeah, I mean, it's very easy to get very cynical about it. And obviously, there are tons of brilliant journalists and brilliant news organizations. And one thing that I'm always trying to be careful about is not in any way to say that, like, we are the answer, because we're not. We're a small team. We make a beautiful magazine, comes out once every 3 months. If you relied on it for finding out what was happening on, you know, what was going on in the world, then, you know, like 3 months after the fact, you'd be like, oh, wow, so Biden got in. You know, there's a pandemic going on. That's why everyone's been dying. There's a pandemic going on. So we're not the answer in that sense. There are tons of, you know, skilled and talented journalists out there doing amazing work, and there are people doing kind of follow-up stories. However, that's not the way that most of the news that we receive works. And part of that is, as you say, it's novelty. It's if it bleeds, it leads, which is kind of, you know, from time immemorial, that is, you know, how journalism has worked. But part of it is also the economics, right? So as you have moved away from, you know, you get up in the morning and you go and buy your particular newspaper, you spend money on it, and, you know, you kind of take it and dissect it and so on. And the editors make their best guess as to what will be interesting and useful to you. You move to a time when news is largely free and has been expected to be free. And the way to monetize it is by, kind of, you know, using the data of the people who are buying it and, you know, feeding them up very invasive, very targeted advertising. And that kind of militates away from considered journalism, right? Because actually, if you're only measuring value in terms of clicks, then the sensible thing to do is not to, you know, is not to commission a 6,000 word considered piece, which, you know, a team of editors work on with a brave journalist, and, you know, you kind of get something really interesting. The sensible thing to do is to bang out a couple of hundred words of nonsense with some sort of sly reference to a celebrity who's in vogue at the moment, put on a provocative headline, and just kind of pump it out and pump out 20 or 30 of those, you know, a day. That's, you know, because then you get the clicks and then you get the advertising and then you can fund things and so on. So there's something rotten about the system. There's an interesting thing, though. I mean, in recent years, I have seen the pendulum start to swing back a little bit, as it always does, right? Which is paywalls, people putting up, you know, paywalls and demanding money for their journalism. And thank God, right? Because we got into a really bleak period. When we launched this magazine, it was, you know, like the only way forward that people saw was in digital. Like print was there, digital, and had to be free, and you had to get mass. And that was really, really kind of scary, because we were educating an entire generation of people to expect that they should get, you know, all of their news for free, even though good news costs money.
Sam Harris has a point around this, that he says the entire internet made a price estimation error in terms of how much it values content. Podcasts shouldn't be free. Everyone that's listening to this right now should be paying me for my time. Everyone should. And they should be paying every other podcaster as well. When you think about the amount of value and pleasure that you get and how engaging it is and how awesome that platform is, and that's just one platform, and then talk about the best follow that you have on Twitter, and then think about the best blogger that you follow that just writes because they like to do it, and the best newsletter that you subscribe to. And yeah, people are picking up the scraps with affiliate deals, and maybe they've got a members area where you can pay for more content, and maybe blah, 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 like freemium model, thin end of the wedge shit. But the bottom line is that when we began the internet, when we began content creation on the internet, we misjudged, the entire universe misjudged what you should be paying for and what you should expect for free. And sadly now, because of anchoring bias, there is that genie can't go back in the bottle. You cannot do that. There is anchoring bias is precisely what people are doing with gated content. They're saying you still get the show for free, but you pay for more, as opposed to this is what you could have got and now you have to pay to get it. It's all about avoiding that anchoring bias. But yeah, I think that the perverse incentives that de-incentivize people from writing good pieces of long journalism that would have taken ages versus can you believe what Khloe Kardashian wore last night? Here's a photo of her with no makeup on going to the whatever. That's going to get shared around and that'll trend. So
yeah, of course. Well, it's even more insidious than that. So it's also, you know, in certain news organizations, what happens is journalists come in the morning and they're given a list of the stories that were trending online overnight, you know, kind of the things that are out there in the ether people were talking about, which is why, you know, these poor buggers, you know, they come into work and they're like, right, write something about this. Who is this? I don't know. It's an American celebrity. She was on some kind of series that you've not heard of. Right. And what's happened to her? Something, I don't know, she's breaking up with a boyfriend. Who's her boyfriend? I don't know. It doesn't matter. Just write something. So, you know, at the bottom end, the other thing that happens with this, of course, and you're absolutely right that there's, I mean, it's not a difficult argument fundamentally, is it, to say that, you know, when you're talking about journalism where you're sending people to difficult and scary places to, you know, to be put into situations that you wouldn't want to be put into on your behalf so you can get information, that should be a fairly easy sell. But the other thing that happens, of course, is that as as the number of media multiply, right? So as you kind of bust outside of the established media, which in many ways was very, very, very good because it empowers a lot of kind of smaller producers to do some interesting things and to experiment. But as you do that, and as their, you know, economic clout comes down and down and down, and as they sort of hemorrhage cash, there's fewer opportunities for journalists to take, you know, what was traditional route of journalism. So in this country, for example, what would happen is you would, you know, you'd start at an entry-level job on a local newspaper and you'd frantically work away. Hopefully some nice editor would take you under their wing and sort of knock some of the rough corners off, rough edges off your writing and so on. You'd start writing pieces and trying to send them to the Nationals, and eventually you get a couple placed, and then eventually you might get something, you know, like, you know, at the Nationals, and then you'd work your way up. There was a kind of a ladder that you could climb. It kind of made sense, right? And so what you end up there with is proper training and, you know, proper experience, and you can do that in a context in which you can make enough money to survive. That sounds like a good way to fund journalism, which, as we all know, is incredibly important to a stable society, right? And to democracy. But the problem is now there's no local news jobs. Local news is basically dead, has been killed by the internet. And there's very few opportunities at the kind of the bigger establishment organizations. So you've still got all of these people wanting to become journalists, still loads and loads of people desperate to kind of go into that. And they come out the other side and they realize there's nothing for them to go into. And so then what they have to do is they have to find some sort of backdoor. So there's the possibility they could launch a podcast. It might take off. It won't. It might, you know, or they could launch their own magazine. It might take off. It won't. It might, you know, and you sort of you're hollowing out the whole ecosystem. And what you end up with is the kind of the few opportunities that there are there tend not to be for the better sort of kind of interesting journalists. And they tend to be this thing where you're just turning the wheel to keep the whole sordid process going.
Talk to me about the difference between first and being right. I heard you talk about the Amanda Knox story as a really good example of this.
The Amanda Knox story was fascinating. So it was this, you know, it was the retrial of Amanda Knox for the murder of Meredith Kircher.
Future Netflix
in Perugia. Star. That's right, yeah. And so this was a highly attended court event in Perugia. And all of the world's major news organizations were there. There's these extraordinary photos of, you know, these banks and banks of people kind of watching the story. And the Daily Mail had prepared two news stories, one for if the verdict went one way and one for if it went the other way. And there was something that happened. Maybe somebody in the court misheard something. You know, it was guilty, but it was guilty to something else, to a lesser charge of slander rather than murder. And the button was pushed and the wrong news story went up online, because as we know, at the retrial, Amanda Knox's the guilty verdict was overturned and she ended up subsequently being released. And so this story goes up on the world's single biggest English language news site, which is the diametric opposite of the truth. And, you know, this sort of thing has always happened, right? Because news organizations, they've always prepared, you know, for eventualities. You think about elections, you know, there's famous examples in the past of people just being certain the election was going to go one way and they published their front story with X won and Y wins. And the thing that they got into trouble with the Mail was that there was quite a lot of kind of elaborated colour. There was quite a lot of elaborated quotes that went in there as well.
What like?
And of course... Well, so I think there was a thing about need to be careful to get this right, but I think there was a thing about the reaction of Knox and of the family, and I think also there was a quote from a court official which I think was not correct, and so you know you have this very weird situation where this wrong story kind of goes up, and you can completely understand why you get to that point, right? Because getting stories out first means that when lots and lots of people are searching for them, that's the story that they land on, right? So people all around the world were interested in this verdict and they wanted to know. So there's this incredible pressure to get the story out first. And obviously the people at the Mail wanted to get it right. But they kind of like, they pushed the wrong button and this went up. It's only up for a couple of minutes and they put the correct story up. And, you know, if the verdict had been, you know, what they thought it was, then that would have been, you know, part of the record of this event for the rest of history, even though stuff in it was not kind of correct. So that's a weird thing. You know, this need for speed in this hyper, hyper, hyper speedy knee-jerk news environment means that we're kind of built for error kind of creeping in. And then more than that, and this is not what I'm sort of suggesting in this case particularly, but you know, the whole ecosystem is built up for spreading disinformation and misinformation very, very rapidly around the world.
You know what it's like? It reminds me of the algorithmic trading companies on Wall Street that moved their exchanges closer, their offices closer to the exchanges to gain half a millisecond.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, because it matters, right? Because the economics of it are such that if you get that story out first, then you're higher in the Google rankings, which means more people link to you. And I mean, I know the algorithm is changing all the time, but you're notionally going to get higher up, which means you can get more clicks, which means you can charge more for the advertising, which means at a time when people aren't prepared to pay for news, you can still continue to fund your organizations. But I mean, if you sat down to construct a kind of a news ecosystem from scratch, you know, it wouldn't be that.
What else are the press getting wrong at the moment?
I'm very loath to criticize the press because I think that by and large, the press is kind of comprised of editors and journalists who are just trying to do their best and trying to get the truth out there. And of course, you know, my magazine, you know, one way we've talked about it is we're slightly the kind of, we're the seagulls following the trawler, right? Because we're not, you know, we're not breaking the news. The slogan down the spine of all of our issues is last the breaking news. So we're kind of following along behind and, you know, we get to look at what has happened and then we get to kind of ask people to take a broader view on it. And there are interesting things around that. So, you know, one of the things that often happens is when people are interviewed about an event, when it's just happened, and sometimes when it's still happening, still unfolding behind them, they tend to give a very different reaction, understandably, to a few months down the line when they've had a chance to consider and put things in perspective. You know, when they're standing in front of the burning building trying to process what's happened, then it's a very different reaction to, you know, 3 months down the line. Okay, think about it.
So people are selecting for witnesses and for statements and for reactions from people and commentators and opinion pieces. They're selecting for a very particular type of opinion.
Well, that's right. So it is the opinion that you get immediately. And also because the media moves, you know, en masse around certain stories, you also get things. So I remember going to Salisbury 3 months after the poisoning. And it's actually my hometown. And just kind of walking around talking to people. And they're like, God, there's just endless journalists. And, you know, people were almost scared to go into the town centre because they would just be stopped. Like, hi, I'm from CNN, hi, I'm BBC, can I, you know, kind of get some words from you? How are you feeling? And I'm feeling fine, just fuck off. It's just like my entire town is now just journalists and like potentially some novichok. So that's, you know, that's another kind of quirk of it. But no, as I said, sorry, I'm very loath to criticize journalists. I think in an ideal world, we would find, and I think, do you know what, I think slowly we're getting there because I think these paywalls seem to be working. And actually, a wonderful example is The Guardian. So The Guardian was losing money hand over fist for many, many years. And they took this kind of very grown up decision to say to their readers, what we do costs money and you need to support us if you want it. We'll keep giving it. We'll do it free because we want reach and we think our journalism needs to reach the four corners of the world. And if you can't pay, no problem at all. However, it costs money, and if you can support us, then do. And they had a tremendous reaction, and they managed to, you know, break even, I think, ahead of where they thought they were going to. So I think, you know, that people are trying to do. I mean, obviously, there's always, you know, as in any organizations, there's obviously kind of, you know, there's bias and there's corruption and there's things that I see happening, which, you know, I think are unpleasant in terms of invasion of privacy and things like that. But, you know, that's been with us forever and probably always will be. But I think, you know, I just have the privilege, I guess, of being able to offer a slightly different view.
The bastards are ubiquitous. It doesn't matter where you are or what industry you're in. The bastards are going to be, they're going to be everywhere. I'm pretty fascinated thinking about what it does to the psyche en masse for people to hear stories, very vociferous, aggressive, eye-catching stories, and never get to hear the conclusion to them, never get to tie up that loose end. That's something I'd never ever thought of before. But it's almost, unless it's a court case in which the court case itself becomes another piece of novelty that people want to get to. The only reason that that closure is being featured is that the closure is also another piece of novelty. But for the most part, you hear the Afghanistan exit is a perfect example. We all knew what happened with those photos of people falling from the plane as it's taking off, that clinging to it as they're running along and they're waving at the camera. And that, I don't know how that's even been completed. I have no idea at all.
Well, this is true. And also, I mean, I suppose the other thing is, arguably, you know, you could do a magazine that does this every 6 months. You could do one that does it every year. You know, there's loads of stories that we could continue to follow up. And, you know, when does it end, right? When did the ripples stop emerging from that story? And I suppose that we've always kind of positioned the magazine as halfway between a magazine and a history book, right? You know, it's like it's sort of, you know, somewhere,
says a lot
somewhere
that 3 months
between
is
the
history.
Two. That's true. I mean, we do deeper stuff than that. So, I mean, it's often the stories are kind of inspired by something that happened in that 3 month period, but we'll reach further back. And what I guess what we try to do is, given that we have these lovely like long form stories that we can do, is we try to get to do what a lot of journalists aren't given time to do, which is provide lots of context and seek out lots and lots of expert opinion. And, you know, like try to take a broad view. And that's very difficult to do if you're having to turn out stories, you know.
But that's the,
at such
the
a tremendous
thing.
Pace.
It's the consistent, ambient, unfulfilled open loop that it has to have an impact on the public's psychology. It has to. You're constantly being fed issues that do not get resolved. That's what the news is.
That's true. And also, of course, I mean, you know, this is not a new thing. And this is just the nature of news as we kind of see it, is that because everything is, you know, not everything, because there's a lot of terribly bleak things out there. And because you want to cut through with your stories, you kind of have to escalate. I mean, you know, this is right. You know, this kind of feeds back to this amazing Anna Lemke you know, interview that we're talking about, that you can't give people the same thing and expect the same reaction. You kind of have to escalate. So, and that's part of the reason, I think, why, you know, so many people have said that they want to switch off the news, you know, and that they feel so much better when they stop reading the news for a few months, because they can't do anything about it. You know, none of the massive issues are anything that we can actually influence. We can't influence government coronavirus policy. We can't influence China's plans to build coal-fired power stations. We can't do anything about any of these things. And yet they weigh on us as though we could, and as though we're not fulfilling it. So you're right. News is very anxiety inducing, which is part of the reason that, you know, that people want to consume it, because they think that if they can consume it, then they can master it and somehow get on top of it. But they can't. I mean, I kind of wish that I could stop reading the news, but I can't, because it's my job.
I got sent a plugin by my buddy George called Tweemex, which is just a plugin for Chrome. And it brings up a highlight of the person whose profile you're on, their top tweets of all time, by likes and retweets. But the most important thing that it does is it covers over the trending portion of my Twitter homepage. So I go onto my newsfeed now and this thing comes up, and if you're not on someone's profile, it just randomly chooses one of the people that you follow. And,
right.
and it brings up their best tweets of all time, which is awesome, because I only follow 99 people. So they're always someone that I know or someone that I absolutely adore what they're doing. But on top of that, it stops me from seeing trending, that trending
right.
thing on the side. And when you realize, when you log on, there is nothing that I can be surprised by now that would go in that point.
Right.
Like, it could be any story at all. I don't know whether you've seen, I can't remember who the comedian is from America that did this, but they pieced together, I think it might have been Ryan Long pieced together how you make an eye-catching headline, and it's
right.
just a bunch of particular group does something in this. So it's outraged mothers fighting over misappropriated cat culture or something like that,
yeah.
And it's just, that's how you piece it together. And he does all of that, and you look at the side of trending and you think, this is the world that we're in, this sort of formulaic algorithmic headline
yeah,
writing.
Yeah, definitely. If you can get some outrage in there, that's amazing, because then you get multiple bites of the cherry, right? So you can scrape together If you look on Twitter, you can find three or four people who are outraged about anything, right? Anything, like, you know, vanilla ice cream, you know, people smiling too much, whatever it might be. Then you find them outraged at this. Vanilla ice cream outrage. And then you get that. And then you get the reaction against that. And then you can report that. I mean, you can go on with this forever. And people kind of do. But I mean, that's funny about the kind of gaming the system, because, you know, it, you know, at the beginning, it used to be stuff like writing the word sex in white on white background 1,000 times over. So people, you know, then obviously that was way too sophisticated, way too unsophisticated. And then that got kind of changed. And then, you know, putting the names of celebrities into your titles, you'd have these incredibly dry publications that for some reason were referencing Britney Spears, and nobody really kind of, you know, like, why are you doing that? You're a plumbing magazine, you know, but you know, it all feeds into it, all health. And this is just the latest part of that, right? Yeah, you just kind of concoct what will work, what will cut through. But the problem is, because we've all been doing it for so long, the sheer outrage you need to cut through if you're going for the outrage angle is difficult. But that said, you know, I sort of mentioned before, you know, this pendulum, it does swing back and people kind of get sick of it. I mean, you know, when we launched, people were so in love with digital. People were prepared to, without any sort of credible business model, they were prepared, long-standing publishers were prepared to say, yeah, I mean, think, you know, like, we're digital first now. How are you going to make money? I don't know. It'll become apparent. What? What are you talking about? What are you talking about? That's bad. And also, you know, how in love people were with their smartphones. I mean, you know, there was nothing wrong with smartphones. And now everybody's uneasy about their smartphones. Everybody's trying to detox, trying to kind of get themselves, wean themselves off it. They're anxious about their kids having it. They know, you know, how much time they're spending just scrolling through, you know, stuff that they don't need to scroll through on social. So I think these things change. And, you know, and actually, so our magazine's a case in point. You know, we've managed to build like a modest subscriber base that funds us to do good journalism.
Using an antiquated communication medium.
That's true. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, going proper old school. But I think almost you need to do that, right? So you need to do the opposite of what other people are doing. So you do print instead of digital. You do reader funded instead of invasive personalized advertising. And you do slow instead of fast. And then you can, it's always going to be a niche, but you might have a niche that works.
I think that you're right about the counterculture thing. And I think that we are at the beginning of that pendulum starting to move, that you see how much support people's Substacks and Patreons get. What do you think, let's say it's 20 years or 30, let's say it's 50 years time. What do you think that the world will look back on this period of limbic hijack and technology that is incredibly unethical, manipulating the most base elements of our psychology to get us to stay on site for this long? What do you think people are going to look back on this period of history and consider?
Wow, that's quite a big question.
I'm aware I'm asking you to be the most sort of divinated clairvoyant that you can, but just...
No, it's funny. So I did this TEDx in 2014, and one of the things that I said, I wanted some nice bold statements for the end, and I said, in 10 years' time, there won't be a single printed... like a single major printed newspaper left in the Western Europe or something like that. And so I'm slightly anxious now because it's got like 2 years to go. There's lots of them.
Come on, guys. TikTok.
Can you just go out of business? I mean, a lot have folded, but still. well, it's funny, isn't it? When you look back, obviously what happens is that all the noise kind of goes away. You know, you look back on entire decades, like the kind of 70s, what was it the decade of? Well, like you can name kind of three or four things, and one of them is disco. So, you know, I mean, you know, all the people who lived through that is absolutely nonsensical. But I would imagine that a huge amount of it will be to do with climate stuff, won't it? So it will be, these guys were such morons. Why didn't they just do, you know, why didn't they just do cold fusion like we've got and sort it out with limitless power? What on earth were we thinking? That's so stupid. Or can you imagine them living in a time before they knew that there were aliens or something like that? It'll be some massive thing that we've not, you know. I think in terms of my strong feeling is that in terms of the way that, you know, big social media organizations have been operating and big tech companies have been operating, I think that that won't persist because I think people won't stand for it. People are getting way too savvy about it. As a very basic thing, people are going to demand to have the value of their information, I think. You know, and all of the technology exists to put that in place, right? People could be micro, you know, compensated for all of the data that is sold behind the scenes about them. And they could also be compensated every time that there's a data breach, you know, every time that people don't haven't kind of protected them, whatever it might be. So I imagine that that sort of thing might mark a shift. But in terms of kind of broader news media, I guess probably it'll still, you know, it'll still be guided by the same things that we want as humans, which is we want to amass enough information that we'll be invulnerable and we'll have a special advantage over all the other humans, and we'll be protected and our families will be protected, which is obviously, you know, nonsense.
Absolutely impossible. Do you have a side interest in data science or something then? Because you've written a book that works out things like how much it would cost to buy everything in an edition of Vogue, or what the actual best inventions since sliced bread have been, or the UK's most popular dog breeds. Are you a closet data scientist too?
So I would never glorify myself as a data scientist. But since we launched the magazine, so in the first issue of the magazine, my co-editor Marcus said, do you know what we should do? We should do some infographics. Infographics are fun. And our art director, who's the best art director in the world, sort of came onto this and said, yeah. So from the very first issue, we started doing infographics and just trying to work out, you know, how we do them. And over years, we've kind of worked out, well, we've got better and better at them, I think. And so actually what happened with this book was, it was April 2020 and the first lockdown. And suddenly we'd gone from selling, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 copies of the magazine at the newsstand to selling zero copies, because nobody was going to, you know, airports, nobody was going to bookshops, nobody was going to train stations. I mean, obviously, as you know, in terms of what was going on at the time, that was a very small drama. But for our business, that was a big deal. And so we were just casting around for something that we could do, a project that we could all throw ourselves into in this time when we were, you know, not going out, when we were just staying at home. And we thought, let's do a book, because we talked about doing a book for ages and we had 10 years worth of infographics. So we started putting stuff together and coming up with new ideas and how it would all look. And then we found an agent and we got an offer from Bloomsbury. So we sold it to them. And then we started putting it together. And I love infographics. And I'm not a data scientist, but I have enough data manipulation skills to pull together, you know, infographics and to do the research for them. And they're brilliant for a magazine because they give you a way in. I think that they are like a gateway drug for magazine purchases. And I've seen people at the newsstand flicking through a copy of Delayed Gratification, you know, and it's not the long form features, the earnest kind of analysis, any of that they stop at. It's the funnies. It's the little infographics, the little things like, oh, wow, oh, that, my goodness. Did you know how many chickens there are? Wow. And so that's, you know, been great for us for the magazine. But I also think that they're really interesting from a journalistic point of view, because you can kind of use them in a way slightly to take the heat out of, you know, kind of quite controversial stories, because you can just, you know, you can just put the facts down, right? And you can kind of give people a way into the facts, you know, that kind of looks good and that kind of amuses them and intrigues them at the same time as hopefully giving them some information. So they're great. And this book is 10 years in the making, and it's got lots and lots of lovely, silly stuff in it, but it's got quite a lot of serious stuff in it. I think I'm glad that you mentioned what's the best thing since sliced bread, because that took me flipping forever to work out how to answer that question. But basically what we ended up doing was getting loads and loads of lists that eminent bodies had produced of the best human inventions of all time. And then we did a meta list. So we totted up all of their kind of votes. We worked out what the most kind of most lauded inventions in human history were post the Industrial Revolution. So it wasn't like fire and the wheel and stuff like that. And then we found out when sliced bread was invented, it was introduced in 1928, I think in June 1928. And then we just looked at the two inventions that were best ranked after that, which were, spoiler alert, they were penicillin and the internet. And penicillin only just scraped under the wire, because I think that was something like September 1928. But that's it, you know. Like that's,
wasn't penicillin so it's grown on bread as well?
Yeah.
So and that's actually, two bread-based. And if we'd been able to make the internet off of bread, we would have had three bread-based inventions.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, let's not rule it out at this stage. Let's see if we can get some funding.
Into bread, yeah. I've got some of my favourite ones that I went through. So the world's oldest person was 122 years old, and she was French, apparently.
Yeah, Jeanne Calment. Yeah, yeah. And so we like looking at old people. So we did this whole infographic at the other end of the book, which was called How to Live Forever. But it had a little asterisk that said up to a maximum of 122 years. And what we did was we looked at supercentenarians, so people who had lived older than 110. And the nice thing about that is that they've all been interviewed at some stage. And I mean, quite often they're, you know, sort of barely kind of capable of giving answers. But the one question everybody has always asked them is, how did you live to such an old age? And the answers are just absolutely delightful. So there's mad stuff like, so whiskey and boiled onions, eating boiled polenta, a sense of humor. Quite a few people said that. Lifelong virginity.
Eugenie Blanchard, lifelong virginity. God, yeah. No alcohol, tobacco, or fooling around.
No fooling around.
No fooling around.
My favorite one is there's a lady who said daily raw steak and brandy and leaving her husband.
Aged 39.
So that's quite nice. Like you can start to get, I mean, I'm not necessarily endorsing lifelong virginity and a all brandy diet to people, but there's kind of nice funny things that you can find out from
I'm
that.
A big fan of May Harrington, who lived to 113, died on the 29th of December 2002, and just has nothing divulged written below
right,
her
yeah.
advice.
Yeah, she's not giving her secrets away. why would she?
Yeah, enjoy dying at 80, bitches.
Yeah, exactly. I knew. I didn't tell.
You didn't know. And then the oldest living creature was a clam that lived to 507 right. years old until he was accidentally killed by researchers.
That's right. I think it was the researchers who found the clam accidentally, in the process of identifying the clam and working out how old it was, accidentally killed it. So, I mean, it could have been, you know, like it could have gone a lot. Didn't have a good innings necessarily.
Unbelievable. The oldest cow, 48 years. The oldest goat, 22 years. 29 years for the oldest dog. There's a 43-year-old spider in here as well, which I do not want to meet.
No, exactly. And with all of these things as well, you know, one thing that we found out in making this book, you know, and going through these billions and billions of kind of data sources, and some of them are actually kind of fantastic, and, you know, many, many diligent people kind of compiling them and so on, is that you also do get to a few where you think, how did you know that? Like, did some, you know, like the spider one, was he just kept in one place for those 40 whatever years it was? I mean, potentially, maybe it was in a zoo or whatever. But if not, you know, is there just a chance that a younger spider scuttled in at some point? Just like, you know,
you've got some concerns around the veracity of the conclusions of the spider research. You can't just cut its leg off and look at how many rings are inside of it. That's not the way it works.
That's the thing. You can't carbon date a spider. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's just a lot of, in terms of kind of the data that's out there necessarily, you know, there's a lot of best guesses and kind of approximations. I mean, actually, if you think about something like CO2 emissions or whatever, you know, we've got these things and broadly they're probably, you know, like ballpark correct. But then also, like, no government in the world, even the most scrupulous and well-funded government, is measuring every single, you know, fire in somebody's back garden or every single kind of, you know, whatever it might be. And certainly that's, you know, that's even the best funded ones. And a lot of people, it'll be, I think, probably just a finger in the air, like approximating it.
Yeah, looking at the CO2 emissions, I was quite interested in this. The UK has seen the biggest CO2 emissions drop of all G20 nations, a decrease of 41%. Since 1990. Meanwhile, China is emitting 11.5 billion tons of CO2 per year, which accounts for 30.3% of the global total. That's one country contributing 30.3% of the entire global total of CO2 emissions.
It's true. I mean, one thing to kind of bear in mind, I suppose, about that, you know, that is an impressive drop by the UK. And a lot of it has been this real kind of like throwing ourselves into renewables. And so actually since 1990, you know, coal-fired power energy production has kind of absolutely plummeted. But another thing that's happened is that manufacturing in this country has effectively been offshored to China. So, you know, our emissions data doesn't take into account the embedded emissions of the products that we buy constantly from China.
That's
and that are kind of, you know, made there using less clean energy and that are shipped here, flown here, whatever it might be. You know, so actually there's loads of different ways of, I mean, even in this, you know, so actually there's three different kind of major standards for how you measure emissions, and some of them take into account, aviation and some of the don't.
Stuff, yeah.
You know, all of these different things. Generally, the UK has done well. It's probably also the case that a lot of the low-hanging fruit for the UK has now been picked. Which actually, you know, somewhere like China, actually, they haven't kind of, you know, made that switch to renewables. But if they did, that would make a massive difference.
I'm terrified of China. Sometimes I just sit and think about what it's going to be like with our new East Asian overlords, which personally I welcome with open arms and have always been an ardent supporter of the Xi Jinping everything that he's done, his hair, his outfits.
Yeah.
His 30.3% of the global total CO2 emissions per year. I welcome them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, so we did an interesting infographic in the book about that. And it was just called How Has China Changed? And we just looked at some of the data about what has happened to kind of, you know, the quality of life of citizens in China in the 20 years, you know, the last 20 years. And it is astonishing, you know, across so many different measures, across, you know, education, public health, you know, earnings, just, you know, all of these different things. Chinese citizens have leapt ahead. Like, their government has brought them incredible, incredible benefits. But I mean, you were absolutely right that they are on the path to becoming our overlords. I mean, certainly economically, one of the kind of the most telling things as well in the book for me was we just looked at how GDP has changed in the kind of the nations of the world with the highest GDP. And it's fascinating because Japan's GDP has increased by something like 3% in that last 20 years. And China's has increased by more than 1,000%. I mean, it is completely, I think the UK is around 97 or something like that. But it's just, I mean, it's an incredible thing that's been happening there in the background, this economic, you know, expansion, which has been coupled with a lot of kind of very good things for some of the citizens and a lot of very bad things for some of the other
totalitarian
citizens.
Totalitarian communist regime is good for the GDP. That's
effective.
That's the, it's effective.
In this case, effective.
Gets the job done. I would love to see an accurately done study around happiness levels and around fulfillment and meaning levels for Chinese citizens. You're never going to, the same as finding out if COVID came from a Wuhan lab or whatever. We're never going to find out. I think it's very unlikely that we're going to find out because you, by its very nature, the people that would be conducting the study have a perverse incentive around the outcomes of the study. But I don't know what it's like to be a Chinese citizen with a social credit score and all of your movements being tracked. And have you seen that they've got gait analysis now on the artificial intelligence system? So even if you don't show your face, they can predict who you are to a 97% accuracy simply by the way that you walk.
Oh, that's petrifying.
Terrifying.
Absolutely petrifying. Yeah. I mean, you also have, you know, what's going on in Xinjiang and with the Uyghurs. You know, this is a kind of a petrifying development. I mean, the other thing to kind of add in, I suppose, about the, you know, there's this incredible expansion, economic expansion, is of course you have to measure it from the base. So actually, you know, Japan 20 years ago was one of the kind of the most developed nations in the world, and China has made this drastic jump.
Finally caught up with everybody else.
Exactly, and of course, I mean, it's the most populous nation on the planet as well. So actually, the interesting thing as well is the GDP is colossal. The GDP per capita for China is still very middling. You know, there's a lot of people not doing kind of particularly well, and there's lots of people who are doing very well. But yeah, I mean, you know, you could do a book of infographics just on China. I mean, just on what's happening. The mad stuff. You know, we looked at the tallest towers in the world. I think at least 7 of them are in China.
The
tallest skyscrapers in the world. So it's completely kind of eclipsed.
There's some place. You know, what's the new one? Because there's a new one. Is it in some Saudi place that's going to...
Oh, the Jeddah Tower.
That's going to wipe the floor with the Burj Al Arab.
Right, that's right.
The Burj Khalifa.
That's right. So Burj Khalifa is your tallest. You've got 6 of the top 10 tallest towers are in China at the moment. And then I think it's the Jeddah Tower, which is scheduled to open in 2024, which is going to be notionally a kilometer high.
And that's where's that? Saudi Arabia somewhere?
That's in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, yeah.
And then I know from my trip to Dubai last winter that they are building in the center of a brand new marina that's going to be downtown, huge downtown marina. They are building just, it's not a building, it's just a spike in the ground. But this spike in the ground is going to be 1.1 kilometers high. So they're already planning to take the title that they're about to lose to Jeddah back and put it in the same place. It's just, I shit you not. It's a spike in the ground.
It does all feel a little bit sort of old fashioned, this, doesn't it? You know, like the sort of showing off competition with towers. I mean, we got a little bit of it. Actually, it was quite interesting with the kind of the recent launches, kind of Bezos and Branson and so on, doing these big launches into space. And a lot of people just saying, why are you doing that? What have you got left to do?
When you've got basically unlimited oil money in the Middle East, what have you got to do other than stick the biggest spike in the world in the ground? That's it. That's all that's left.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose so. I mean, that's kind of that's slightly the Bezos argument, although Bezos is also saying that, you know, we're going to learn loads of stuff from him going into space. But I don't know. It feels a bit of an old-fashioned way to spend your billions, doesn't it?
Do you see what Elon tweeted recently, talking about how people were criticizing him for not paying tax on his unrealized gains from stock holdings? So he did a Twitter poll to say, should I just dump 10% of Tesla stock? And I'll abide by whatever the results of this poll are. And that ended up with a Twitter poll deciding the fate of $20 billion worth of stocks. And they decided on yes. It ended up at 57% said yes. So it sounds like if you're holding Tesla stock, might be an idea to just get out of the market for the time being and then rebuy back in, because Elon's about to dump a little bit.
Oh, God save us. But I mean, it keeps us in interesting stories, right?
It keeps
us something to talk about.
Dog breeds. I love this one. I love dogs. The most popular dog crossbreed was Cockapoos, with 39,000 being sold through Pets for Homes in 2020. This is in the UK. 10 of the 24 most popular dog breeds has poodles as parents, and Cavapoos are the most expensive dogs. Now, I know a lot of people that have got Cockapoos, so I anecdotally can completely back this.
Yeah, well, this was fascinating. So this was something that we looked at in the magazine first, right? Because it was a big phenomenon about COVID and the lockdown. So actually, we did a ton of infographics about COVID. I mean, there was so much amazing data there to play with. And this was a fascinating peripheral one. It was going through this unbelievable inflation. So there's two things going on. So people getting more and more interested in crossbreeds. And they were also paying more and more and more for them. And so we got this incredible data. And quite often, you know, for the book, we would kind of go and approach somebody that we thought had some interesting data. And Pets for Homes did have interesting data. They sell kind of tons and tons of dogs. I think one of the things that I like the most, though, I'm not particularly a dog person, but I do love the kind of these portmanteau names. So you've got, you know, you've got Cavapoo and Maltipoo and Golden Doodle, but you've got Pomsky, Poochon, you've got Sproodle, you've got Sprocker, a Mulshy, a Morky, a Pomchy, a Chalky, a Puggle, a Jug, and a Shorky. And just kind of lovely, lovely things. But the prices for these things were insane. I mean, actually, the thing to really invest in over the last year has been crossbreed dogs.
Dogs.
Yeah.
Crazy. I'm trying to work out what it is about poodles that make them, because I know that Cockapoos are, I want to say, hypoallergenic, which sounds like the sort of thing that you look for in a bed pillow. Oh, yeah, well, thankfully, because Jonathan, he's got infertigo, so we need to have a hypoallergenic fucking pillowcase for him, or else he comes out with a rash. Like, but yeah, I think that there's something.
But no, you've answered it. That's exactly right. But it's the poodles that are hypoallergenic.
Okay, so they pass that down. That's a dominant gene, is it? Like having brown eyes. The hypoallergenic nature is that gets passed down. Even if you mate that with a Dulux dog, the Dulux dog's genes just get completely whitewashed by the poodle.
Now that, you have me there. I think that's the case, but you know what? I don't want to definitively say that. But can I tell you about, so I'm really glad that you picked that one up. The other one that I loved from the lockdown was, and the other kind of really novel bit of data that we got, was we looked at what people were searching for across the world during lockdown. And it was kind of, it was so revelatory, because it's such a weird experience that we've all had, right? We all went through this, and you know, a third of the world at one point was in some form of lockdown. And we did quite earnest stuff about the disease and how it spread, and you know, the financial impact and so on. But the really human story, and I think that's where the infographics work best, is when they kind of got this real human story at the heart of it, was what people were searching for on Google. And we went to Google and we said, look, the sort of thing that we're looking for is you know, kind of data that tells us about, you know, how people's priorities changed. So the data that we got was searches that had increased the most year on year. So the year before the pandemic and then the year after. And then we drilled down, we got it kind of day by day. So we related it to how the whole thing unfolded. So fascinatingly, before the coronavirus was declared a pandemic, the big thing that people were searching for was hoarding. You know, we can all remember there was this unease and, you know, there were things starting to kind of, people were starting to hoard things and we weren't quite sure what's going on. And then in order, and this isn't all of them, but it went hoarding, toilet paper, coronavirus, people just across the world in every language under the sun just going, what is coronavirus? Hydroxychloroquine, when Trump was just like, I'm interested in this, this is going to sort things out. Ammunition, so driven by people in the States being like, right, it's the end of the world, let's load up. Exercise bike. My absolute favorite bit is on day 12, there's two searches that spike. The first one is homeschooling. So people just being like, how the hell do I do this? And the second one is, when will schools open? Then you had social distancing, which is a term that had never been searched for in a quantity that it would register on Google's radar before. Complete breakout term. Same with Zoom dating, cut your own hair, permit to go outside. This is lovely. Cafe sounds on YouTube. People hadn't searched for that before.
Make themselves feel like they were in a cafe while they were sat at home.
Like they were in a cafe. So, you know, what they used to do in the old days was go to a cafe. And then they were just sitting at home on their bed and just be like, God, this is a bit
it's
sad.
Too fucking silent in here. Let me get the sound of Sheila making a cup of tea.
So, which, you know, was the market provided, like the clink and the clank and the sort of, you know, people tamping down espressos or whatever. Unmute on Zoom. How to make your own McDonald's.
That's the most boomer search ever.
Isn't it? That's a bit, why is my face not here?
Yeah.
Where are my grandchildren? Yeah, how to make McDonald's. And then, you know, all of this kind of stuff, all of this kind of stuff, the, you know, like mad kind of social stuff. And then another breakout thing, and this was quite a long way down the line, but how many people can attend a funeral? This was a breakout search that people hadn't had to think about before because, well, as many people as can fit in the church or crematorium. But that was the thing that people were searching for en masse around the world. So I love that sort of data, you know, where it's both epic because it's on a global scale, but it's also personal and immediately, you know, relatable. You understand it.
Are you familiar with Seth Stevens Davidowitz?
Yes. Everybody Lies. Yeah.
So Seth's been on the show and that guy's a beast with his data. And yeah, I saw a feature that he did. He was able to predict, him or his office were able to predict the rates of COVID infections 3 to 5 days ahead of the CDC based on aggregated Google data, based on people searching for loss of taste, high temperature, loss of smell.
Wow.
And if you map loss of taste, high temperature, loss of smell, and a couple of other searches that were common, if you map those on the graph, you see that they're just a lead measure for the lagging measure that ends up being COVID cases. Crazy.
Yeah. Well, is there not this idea also that, you know, you could absolutely use people's kind of search history. You could have kind of algorithms kind of constantly scanning and if people opted into their search histories and just kind of patching together, firstly, outbreaks of kind of various different infectious diseases, but also, you know, you could correlate it with other information that you have about them and say, do you know what, actually something could pop up and say, you should go to your doctor and get this checked out. You know, you have searched for this particular bowel issue several times and it's probably okay. But, you know, like, you know, you could just get so much more joined up about all of this, particularly if you also had, of course, you know, if you were linked into their kind of their blood pressure and, you know, all the things that are going through on their wrist and so on. But
thinking in a techno-utopian way, it's a bit of a shame that the period of the world that we're living in at the moment, everybody is incredibly protective about their data because we do not believe that the people who are mining our data have our best interests at heart. You could imagine another world in which the Mark Zuckerbergs and the Jeff Bezoses of the world were just seen as these benevolent saints, right? These sort of technocracy saints that were just, all that they did was make our lives better. And we knew that they had our best interests at heart, and they weren't selling it, and they weren't trying to limbically hijack us. And we just wanted more. We wanted to just continue to give ourselves away. But because of the framing that this situation's been given, because of concerns around privacy and human, I had Sebastian Junger on the show not long ago talking about the brutal history of freedom. And freedom is something that we have been fighting for a very, very long time. So when you start to encroach on that, humans have a very visceral response. They're really, really not happy about it, and understandably so. But there could have been, this could have been done a different way, and we may end up in a place where it is done in a different way. But the amount of time it's going to need to regain the public's trust of big tech. Think about big tech. The word's big tech. It makes you think of this dark, malevolent being, you know, hiding at the top of some fucking gilded tower behind an astroturfed lawn. Like, that's that, you know, it's Silicon Valley run amok. And that's what we think about. We think they're selling our data. They're trying to target us with ads. I don't want them to even know my fucking name, let alone my blood pressure. That's how we feel about this situation. But it could have been different. And it would have been nice. It would have been nice to have wanted to supply as much data that you have to these companies as possible. Maybe, I have no idea about this, but maybe Web3 will be able to enable this a little bit more, because you can have genuine levels of security. And I don't understand how it works, but someone said that it sounds like it might be a better version than the internet we have at the moment.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't be difficult, would it? But I mean, you're absolutely right. There was very much a missed opportunity there, because actually, when all of these things started, we could only see the benefits, right? I mean, you know, some people were moaning because actually it turned out that all of the people that they looked up on Facebook from their childhood, you know, there was a reason that they weren't in touch with them anymore, and they're all pricks.
Been reminded, but, you know, why actually, they were assholes that I wasn't friends with. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. So there were things like that. But generally, there was a lot of, wow, and I get this for free. Wow. And, you know, there were incredible social benefits and people kind of reconnecting. And there were wonderful, wonderful, wonderful things. And you're absolutely right. There must have been a moment at which you built enough. But the problem is, you only build enough mass by making it free, because there can't be that barrier to entry. But once you set up that relationship where, you know, the people, you know, we are not the clients, we're the products, it's very difficult to turn that round. And at some point you say, tell you what, do you want this, but you pay for it and we won't mess around with your data? Or, well, I mean, you can't, there's no way you can package that up. You have to continue. Once you've set this course, it has to be all about freedom. But I don't know. I think, you know, the wiser that people get about what is happening and what it's, I mean, less so about the data, but what it's doing to your mental health, I think, to be kind of, to leave yourself this open to constant distraction and constant kind of titillation and constant anxiety and so on. The more people move away from that, and the more people, you know, capitalism moves in and it provides alternatives, not necessarily quarterly printed magazines, but like other stuff, other tech stuff, you know, where there's a kind of a kudos associated, and, you know, you pay for it, but you get a better service.
That's the visceral response. The fact that everybody understands that their relationship, I don't know a single person whose relationship with technology doesn't need work. And 10 years ago, that would have almost not been the case. I don't know a single person that doesn't need to work on their relationship with technology. And the fact that that's there and it's so obvious, and it's felt, it's a felt sense by everyone, that's the gateway drug to people saying we need to have a system-wide change with how technology and us relate. You might see something when we move more towards AR and VR and wearables being a little bit more integrated. When you get a step change in the type of media mechanism or the type of consumption mechanism, you may be able to reset some of the market's expectations to do with cost, to do with relationship between you and the supplier or the tech company. So that may be something. But again, it's just anchoring bias. It's the fact that until you change a bunch of different things at once, we fix ourselves to, well, this was free, and so many people want to have all of the things that they think that they want with none of the things that they know that they don't want. So I want to still be able to access my friends and talk to them, but I don't want them to limbically hijack me, but I also don't want to pay for it. And it's like, you don't get to have those three things. Like,
exactly.
The reason it's free is because they're selling your data and they're targeting you with ads. So another one of the things that you looked at, which was the decade with the most blockbusters based on an original idea.
And that yes.
That was the 1980s.
It was the 80s.
Unsurprisingly, the 2010s came last. Last out of the last 100 years. The last century, the worst decade for blockbusters based on an original idea was the 2010s.
Isn't that fascinating? Yeah. I mean, it's all kind of based on, well, it's kind of remakes and it's based on storybooks and things like that. And if you look at it, the 80s, you had, so the biggest, you know, biggest film of each year in terms of ticket sales, you had Star Wars, Episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back. So you've got you've got 1980, you've got Star Wars. And then you've got 81, you've got Raiders of the Lost Ark. 82, you've got E.T. 83, you've got another Star Wars. 84, you've got Indiana Jones. Back to the Future, Top Gun.
Spielberg is banking it, isn't he?
I mean, you know, Indiana Jones, The Lost Crusade, all just kind of just original ideas, not based on anything. That stuff is absolutely lovely. I think one of the nicest things that we've done in film is, and I always kind of come back to it, is How to Win an Oscar. So we just looked at every single Oscar winner going back to 1928, every single male and female winner of the Best Actor category. And it's fascinating because we looked at kind of like modally how you're most likely to win. Because everybody's got that question when it comes around to Oscar season, like, you know, who's going to win? And you've all got your pet theories. And actually, it's fascinating to see the facts, which is that, modally speaking, you'll play a fictional character who's North American, from the present day if you're a man, from the recent past if you're a woman, who works as a soldier, a lawman, a monarch, a politician, a creative slash media type, or a performer if you're a man. And how depressing is this? Who works as a performer, a housewife, a mother, a socialite, a service industry type, or a prostitute slash escort if you're a woman in that order, who participates in no sexual scenes, and who in the end doesn't die on screen. And these are very clear trends as well. Like, you know, it's fictional character and it is North American. Now, none of that is necessarily particularly surprising. But I think one of the nice things about diving into data sets like this is it kind of allows you to confirm, you know, or confound the prejudices and the ideas that you already have about, you know, what you would expect to see going into this story. But I love that one in the films. A lot of cultural stuff is really nice. We did a lovely one about, we got this data from Spotify about songs that have stood the test of time. So the songs from each year going back to the 50s that are the most played now. So, you know, like, I think like, yeah. And it's quite funny because actually it's almost like a list of guilty pleasures. It's a bit like, you know, Seth's book, Everybody Lies. You know, you tell the truth to Spotify because you actually want to listen to those songs. And you might, you know, if you were asked to compose your list of the best songs of the last 50 years, whatever.
None of those are going to feature on
none
that.
Of that shit.
One of my buddies is absolutely adamant that the window into a person's soul is their suggested videos on YouTube Home. That someone watches between 10 p.m. and 11 p.m. at night on a weekday evening on YouTube, that's who they really are. Not the person that they tell you, not who they are with their lover in their most vulnerable moments. It's the shit that they watch between 10 p.m. and 11 p.m. at night on YouTube.
Yeah, I could see that. And that book, Everybody Lies, there was a lot of stuff in that, wasn't there? Because he has this lovely example, which is, you know, what people write about their partner on Facebook as opposed to what they type into Google about their partner is mad. It's like, you know, my boyfriend is so sweet, charming, kind, generous, like, you know, adorable, whatever it is. And then people are typing into Google, my boyfriend is horrible. Is my boyfriend autistic? What's wrong with my boyfriend? Why is my boyfriend so mean? And that's how we use Google. It's like, it's, you know, like it's an electronic psychiatrist on the couch, isn't it? Why is this happening? I mean, one of the things that I liked the pandemic searches, one of the things people were just doing in large enough numbers for it to register a massive spike was just going into Google and typing in, I'm bored. And that's amazing. What do you fucking want them to do? And it's a search engine. But I mean, it's actually, you know, it probably would throw up some useful stuff. But I love that. Just people, you know, all around the world in all different languages. I'm bored.
569 people have been to space. 24 went to the moon, 12 of which walked on the moon, and 3 went to the moon twice. Plus, we left 2 golf balls on the moon because one of the astronauts played golf up there.
That's right. Yeah. So actually pulling together that data was quite a colossal job because it's not centralized. So I'm not sure that anybody's ever calculated that before. There are kind of various different calculations floating about the place. But we got the kind of the data from NASA and from the Russian Space Agency and from the Chinese Space Agency and from the kind of the private companies. And so, yeah, so we kind of went through methodically and we've listed them all. I mean, I think that this is one of the nice things about this, An Answer for Everything. It's just there's this thing where you quite want to own knowledge, right? I mean, you're never going to sit there and read through the list of every single person who was sent into space in 1984. But I like having it in a book that I own. It's just nice. I like it. Like, it's completism. That's what it is. It's any time that you could be completist about something. Every single person, they're immortalized.
Inherently satisfying.
It is satisfying. And, you know, like, why not? Why not spend 8 pages going through and, like, calling out the most exciting things that they've done? And then, yeah, I mean, there's loads of lovely. We had the NASA. I mean, there's so many data sources that, you know, obviously we couldn't do without them. NASA have got these amazing data sources about stuff that we left on the moon. So there's hammocks for, you know, because the astronauts kind of went up and they didn't really cater for where they were going to sleep when they first sent them. So they were kind of effectively sort of sleeping all hunched up in the spacecraft. And eventually they graduated to hammocks and they chucked them out afterwards. There's quite a lot of excrement up there. There's, you know, there's unused sick bags. There's this amazing thing where there's a stack of money. And it's a special, I think it's $2 bills or something like it. And somebody thought that they would take it up there and then they could go back down and then hand them out as souvenirs, you know, because this is a special bill and it's been on the moon. Wow. You know, that's amazing. But at some point they jettisoned it. Like they thought it was a bad idea or they took off and they're like, how have I forgotten something? Oh, fuck.
I've left $42 down on the moon.
Exactly. That was my ticket to the big time. So, I mean, that's the other thing is you find out how weird the world is. There's a lot of long tail stuff as well. I don't know if you saw, we did one about government e-petitions. So the UK government has set up a few years ago an e-petitions portal, and you can go on there and you can suggest an e-petition. And if you get enough votes on your e-petition, I think it's 100,000 or something.
10,000 is that it will be noticed by someone. 100,000 is that it gets brought up in the House of Lords, I want to say.
It's something like it. Is it like it gets considered for debate in Parliament?
Yes, that's it. Yes.
Something. And a certain number of them have been, you know, have kind of broken through, a tiny percentage. The vast majority of them, and I went through and found out, you know, I went through every single year how many were submitted, how many were kind of like rejected. The vast majority of them rejected. And there's this lovely government line that they put underneath. And so it says like e-petition rejected, reason for rejection. And usually the line is just really polite and it just says, this e-petition does not relate to something that the government is responsible for. And it's like, no shit. So like some of my favorite ones on there, there's this brilliant one, which is change the plural of sheep to sheeps. Make gingerism part of the discrimination laws. And my absolute favorite one, there's somebody went on there and started an e-petition, which was increase the standard size of a wine bottle to 1 liter. And they had this lovely little write-up under it. And it just said basically, you know, you finish a wine bottle and you always want just one more glass. So why not make wine bottles a litre and then you don't have to open a second bottle? I mean, it's brilliant. And then the government rejected it. They're like, yeah, it's not really.
That's this not isn't our remit, us. Mate. This is a problem. Yeah.
We're more NHS and stuff.
Yeah. Fuck, man. Yeah, the number of times that I've seen a spurious e-petition go up. But it does seem like, I don't know, that system for Americans, I don't know if there's an equivalent for Americans, but that system is a rage outlet for a lot of people's social justice concerns. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that people believe, the people that are voting on it, believe that they're genuinely making a change by doing that thing. That's the way that I'm going to contribute to this particular movement. So, for instance, there's been a recent social concern around spiking in nightclubs. I'm not sure if you've seen
right.
this.
Yeah.
Huge concern around it. And I run nightclubs in the UK, so it means that we've been dealing with this on the front lines, as it were. And the main thing that people were pushing toward there was, we're going to do an e-petition. We're going to get this to be considered for debate in wherever Parliament. And one way that you could look at that e-petition page is that it's a simulacrum of doing work whilst not requiring any of the things that might actually enact change. That it gives people who are indignant and want to contribute to a social movement, it gives them an mm-hmm. outlet that dissipates their rage, but doesn't, by the numbers, seem to actually make change all that often.
That's right. I mean, I think you do get certain breakthrough ones. And when you're going through them, there are certain bees in bonnets that are just, you know, it's like everybody's putting up a thing over and over and over and over again. But you're right. There's a certain amount of virtue signaling going on. You know, you share an e-petition on your socials and that's kind of like you've done something about it, but you haven't actually done anything about it. There was this amazing statistic, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but there's this frighteningly high percentage of news stories where they are shared online before people have read the story at all.
So you basically get a warning on Twitter if you do that now.
Do you?
If you retweet an article, if you retweet an article without Twitter, without opening the link, and Twitter knows if you've opened the link, Twitter pops up and says, "You haven't read this. Do you want to read the article before retweeting?"
That's amazing. Because somebody did an amazing spoof on it where they put in some quite, somebody did something amazing where they put in this quite powerful headline, which was kind of virtue signaling headline. And then there was, I think there was a paragraph of real text. And then underneath it, the text basically said, "You're all a bunch of idiots. And if you've read this far, then kind of congratulations. But this is all nonsense and kind of made up." And people were just sharing it kind of willy-nilly. "Oh, yeah, this is important work. You've got to read this." You know, I mean, our whole digital system is kind of geared up for that. I don't know, though. I don't know whether you're right. At some level, it's just kind of a pressure valve and it's a way of making people feel that they've done good. But also, I suppose I kind of applaud any government that's prepared to wade through. I mean, there's something quite nice about that. Some official going through and being like,
"The fucking guy in that department. Can you imagine? Can you imagine that poor bastard's job?"
"No, we're not going to make gingerism part of the discrimination laws. No, we're not going to give you extra large bottles of wine. Just buy a third size bottle of wine. It's not to do with us. I want to serve."
What have I missed off? What was one of your favorites from the book that we haven't covered?
Good question. So there's all sorts of lovely things. I think there's a very simple one that I really like, which is just called "Where the Babies Come From." And I'm really interested in this, which is that it's just about fertility rates around the world. And I read this really, really good book a few years ago, Empty Planet. I interviewed one of the authors. There's two authors. I think I interviewed John Ibbotson. And it's basically saying that if you look at the fertility rates, as in the number of babies that women around the world are having, in many, many countries, they are way below replacement rate. So in a modern economy where you've got a good chance of your kids, very good chance of your kids surviving through childhood, you need to be having something like 2.1 kids per woman in the population in order to maintain your population static without any immigration. And in dozens and dozens of countries around the world, that is not the case. And in many, it's nowhere near the case. And the trend is all downwards. And a lot of that is a good thing, because a lot of that is people moving from primarily agricultural societies to more urbanized societies. It's women becoming educated and realizing they've got more options. It's people leaving it later to have kids, and it's birth control. There's all sorts of wonderful things. But, you know, their argument in this book, which we did kind of a big feature on, was that what's going to happen is we're going to reach a tipping point with the global population much earlier than the UN is predicting. And that after that, it's only going to go one direction. The global population of humans will shrink year on year on year on year on year. And nothing's going to change it, because the economics of it kind of won't change. You've tried, you know, all of these governments have tried basically bribing people to have kids. You've got Scandinavian countries that are setting up the most amazing benefits for people who have kids. Still, they don't want to have lots of kids. You know, China's kind of like pulled the brake on its one child policy, and now it's pulled the brake on its two child policy. And it's saying, you know, if you want three, that's fine. You can have three. And they're talking about what the world will be like, you know, with this diminished population. What it means is you'll have a much older population. So you'll have far fewer young people paying for a lot more old people. And they're talking about some interesting things that might happen, that you might possibly have a less aggressive society, because you'd have fewer kind of young men, you'd have more oldies just about the place. But then conversely, you might have a lot more very frustrated young men, because, you know, they're just basically spending their entire lives paying for the pensions of the people who went before them. And then this, you know, that was an 8-page feature. And then just kind of condensing it to the basics, you just got a map of the world and you color code it by the places that are making babies at a sustainable rate and those that aren't. And it's fascinating, because the world is just colored in. you know, like North America, most of South America, all of Europe, large swathes of Asia, people aren't having babies at a sustainable rate. And it's going to shift everything. It's going to change everything. You know, you've got people like, I think Taiwan's down at, you know, just above one. You know, that's nowhere near enough for its population to sustain. So that's going to have interesting impacts in terms of everything, in terms of environment. You know, it could be that the thing that saves us is not technology. It's not people changing their lifestyles. But it's just that, you know, humans, you know, the human population just starts to wither away, hopefully in time to mitigate the worst excesses of climate change, maybe not. You know, you might completely have a sea change in your attitude towards refugees. You might start to think that you really, really, really needed them. You wanted to welcome in. Everything could change. I just love that you have a double page spread, a very simple map, and hopefully you can spark a lot of conversations around that very easily.
People in Chad pumping out nearly 7 children per That's woman.
Right. That's right. But it's all still trending down.
Is that right? And then the bottom 5, Singapore at 1.16, the United Arab Emirates at 1.14. So that's interesting to me because both of those are very wealthy countries.
Yeah.
Super wealthy countries. Andorra, 1.13, Puerto Rico, 1.1, and Taiwan at 1.06. Yeah, that's I wouldn't have guessed. I don't know much about Andorra or Puerto Rico, but I wouldn't have guessed Singapore, the United Arab Emirates, or Taiwan to be in that bottom 5.
I mean, religion factors into it as well, of course. As you have a kind of a less religious society and, you know, the religious strictures around, you know, populating the earth and not using contraception and so on, as they fade away. The real key thing, or one of the real key dynamics, though, is moving out of villages. Because in villages, everybody knows you and you're under immense social pressure to have kids, particularly if, you know, if there's a level of a kind of religiousness there as well. But when you move to the city, nobody knows you. There's nobody sort of saying, oh, are you still no kids, eh? Oh, okay. You know, nobody's wagging their finger. Plus also you can get, you know, an education and you can move on with your lives. And it turns out that when people do that, they don't want so many kids.
It's scary, man. When you think about what the development of birth control and the decline of religion, those two things, no one could have predicted that that was going to mean. I don't know. Does it look like the global population is going to break 10 billion or will it? Do you think it'll slow before that?
So there's all sorts of different things. So I think the UN one has us breaking 10 billion. This one that, but actually, I think to be fair, the UN has got 3 different scenarios.
Okay, yep.
And one of them has
some
us breaking.
Fucking, loads of fucking, less fucking.
That's right. Yeah. It's like a fucking scale.
Yes.
Yeah. It'll depend on where we get to on that scale. But yeah, under some scenarios, you know, in 20 years time or so, you start
glance off the bottom
down
of 10 billion or something like that.
And then it never stops. You know, the decline, I mean, presumably it stops when you get to 2 people, but you know, like it's one person, but it you know, that decline will continue because it obviously each generation shrinks. You know, there's fewer people having fewer kids.
What's the solution to that? Does he propose one?
Well, I think that they, I think in the book, they think that we don't kind of need a solution. We just need to be ready for it, you know. So actually, there'll be tons and tons of benefits. You know, if indeed the population sort of, you know, levels off and then starts to decline quite rapidly before we've totally messed up the environment, then that will have incredible benefits. Like each year, there'll be fewer people consuming. You know, the quality of life for the people who remain, well, I mean, that's quite broad staking because obviously there's a lot of implications about kind of a dwindling society and having fewer people to kind of do the jobs and so on. But from an environmental, from a global point of view, actually the environment, you know, could be a massive, massive beneficiary. And that was one of the big things that they talked about. And they just said, you know, this will be another thing that humans have to adapt to. But it's something that bears thinking about.
Yeah, well, I mean, if everything's going to become automated and there's going to be no jobs for us in any case, if robots are going to take over everything, it doesn't matter. There's only going to be 2 people left. Yeah, I wonder, because there has to be a level that things flatten out at, that they're, or else we're talking about this as the next big extinction event. That imagine if we make it through global pandemics, world wars, nuclear weapons, we avoid destroying ourselves, we avoid all of the asteroids, and the fact that we're not fucking enough annihilates the human race. How did that civilization go extinct? Oh, they just got bored with sex. They just got bored with it and they didn't do it enough and they that was it. But here's another thing, man. Imagine we could be living through the period where there are the most humans on the planet that there will ever be.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That will probably be another kind of like thing to chalk up in our lifetimes. But then of course, you know, like making predictions about these things is kind of nonsense. You can see where the numbers are trending and so on. But also, say the robots do take over and we've got loads and loads and loads of lovely spare time. Do humans start to reorient their lives again?
Yeah.
I mean, they don't need to work to provide. You know, maybe they're living to 120. Yeah. So they could dedicate 30 years of their lives just to study, and maybe they can have babies when they're in their 70s. So maybe that's the thing. Maybe you start pumping out babies in your
70s. Nobody foresaw the fucking revolution of the 2040s.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Led by 70-year-olds.
Yeah.
Led by randy 70-year-olds, you know, on a mission to repopulate the Earth. I mean, who knows? Who knows any of these things?
I agree. Rob Orchard, ladies and gentlemen, an answer for everything, 200 infographics to explain the world, will be linked in the show notes below. Where else should people go if they want to hassle your company on what it is that you do?
So go to slow-journalism.com and find out all about the magazine and subscribe for a very reasonable rate of £40 a year. And come to some of our events. We do fantastic free events where we do in-depth chats with journalists about their stories. We really kind of get behind the scenes of that. Come to one of our classes. We'll teach you how to make infographics. We'll teach you how to be a features writer, teach you how to launch a magazine, you know, any number of different things, how to be a graphic journalist. Come along to one of those and get the book. It's, do you know what, this book, this is your classic Christmas book. It's 17 quid, but it feels like it's worth 25, which is nice. You know, it's got heft to it. It's got volume. And I kind of picture myself as I almost am, you know, wandering around Waterstones like a lost sheep on the 23rd of December thinking, I got to buy for all the, who am I going to buy? What am I going to get? What do they even like? This is good because this has got politics, culture, sport, film, you know, environment, everything. There's something in there for everybody. So it can look like you've chosen it for just that. You'd be like, yeah, I saw they've got a chapter on designer dogs and stuff like that. And I know you like dogs. So here's your Christmas present. So this is good. This is where we're aiming at. It's like four square in the center of that, you know, like that panic buying Christmas market. That's
very well thought out.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it. Rob?
Yeah.